Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel's
feeding it! Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
One day I just would like to have a podcast where I just get to bury Russ every 10 seconds. You don't know the pain, Corey. You don't know the pain that I go through each and every week. Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim Jerome coming at you with another episode of The Suspendables. Each and every week. There it is. Oh, yeah. Each and every week, me and Rusty get together to bring you all sorts of frivolity and stories. And this week we got a guest. We love our guests. Russ and I think we're great, but every time we have a guest on, we get better ratings. We get higher volume of people. And anytime I have a chance to find a guest who knows Russ, who played with Russ, I'm like, fantastic. Bring this on.
Here we go.
Okay? I want this guy. I would really love someone to come on. Well, as I look around, can I say, and just pound Russ like a fucking post, okay? I really would. I'll tell you what, Rusty, our guest, you've been mentioning this a long time. You guys go back. Corey Hirsch is our guest. And I read, his Wikipedia and stuff. Great career, lasted, 1992 to 2006. Tons of awards, man, that he won as a junior player and a minor league player. And then, of course, a cup in New York. Phenomenal story. And then, of course, this personal life, of course, if you don't know, we're gonna get to talk about that today. I read the article, Rusty, was a few years ago, 2017, by the Player Tribune, I think is the where that piece came out. Mm-hmm. And when I read this, I've got to admit, I was brought to tears. I was never so moved by someone who was in a place that looked, man, this thing's going to go down the tubes to mm-hmm. where it is today. So we're going to talk about that for sure in the show. But I want to find out stories about Russ. And you know what? Music to my ears.
Piss off.
Corey was listening as we talked at the top of the show. He's like, I've got a few stories about Russ. Corey Hirsch, how are you, man?
Hirschy!
I'm doing fantastic, but hey, here's my...
Oh, there we go.
And it's nice. Since I'm not drinking anymore, it's a fake beer. So, Russ, I'm going to join you. Cheers.
Molson's.
Yeah, it's fake. It's Molson's. It could be called fake. It's got to be... It's beer, but it's just got no alcohol in it. That's all.
When I played in Montreal, we had our team picture, and Peter Molson was there, and... Ryan Walter, who didn't drink also for religious reasons, really. He had a beer at the odd time, but he was very religious, so he didn't drink. But before the picture, I said to Peter Molson, the owner of the team in Montreal, I said, are you going to come out with a non-alcoholic beer? And he goes, I'm leaving that fake shit to my brother.
I'll tell you what, Rusty, it was for religious reasons that I drank and did drugs for all those years. I was like, yeah, it's because of religious
hallelujah.
Reasons. Yeah, hallelujah. Thank you, God.
I don't drink anymore because I'm just an asshole when I do. I mean, there's... right? That's... Everybody's got a reason.
Yeah. Well, Corey, thanks a lot for doing this, man. We really appreciate it. I kind of got to know you through these stream of texts that we had. When we got a hold of you and you agreed to come on the show, that was great. And then you guys started the little volleying back and forth.
Yeah. Going,
tell this story, Corey. No, Russ, you tell this one. You tell that one. One of them was, so I wrote them down. Let's start about, because I think it was you who got stung in this scam. About scam, the back-to-back.
Not a
credit,
scam. A game.
Yeah, but if Russ is involved, okay, Russ is winning, okay? Yeah. Russ is winning. The back-to-back credit card losses, Corey. What was that story all about?
Russ can tell the story.
Explain the deal.
But I think there was tape on the bottom of my credit card. And I think it was rigged. I really.
How does it work? Tell me how it
Russ,
works.
Russ tells it better than I do, so I'll let Russ tell.
We're in. I've told this story a couple times, Hershey, but I'll refresh it. So we're in Pittsburgh, and we're at either Mastro's or Ruth Chris or something like that, and the bill's around $4,200, I think. And after we divide it, so let's say there's 10 guys there, it's $420 per person. You can either pay or you throw your credit card in the wine bucket, and the last credit card out has to buy dinner. And Dean Malka, Corey, and I were tighter than tight. We hung out a lot, and it was so much fun. And Dean would always get into Corey's kitchen and say, come on. Corey didn't want to play, and he's like, come on, play. Boom, that last card out, Corey loses. So we're on a long trip, and we're on the East Coast. And 3 nights later, we're at another restaurant, and we're all together again. And again, it's around $4,000.
Oh, no.
And Dean says to Corey, come on, Hershey, you can't lose two in a row.
Oh, no.
Boom. Freaking back-to-back losses.
Oh,
and
no.
Corey turns to me and goes, that's my entire paycheck.
Yeah, no shit.
All the rich guys, right? Like, the guy's making $1 million. I mean, they don't make the money that they made today, but I'm making like $1.50. And right, all these other guys making $1 million. And it was like every time. And you know what? I didn't want to go out that night because I was still hurting from the last one. I'm like, no way. They're going to play again. I'm not going for dinner with them. Mally comes to my door. Come on, Hershey. Let's go. And then so I go. And then it's like, come on, Hershey. You can't lose two in a row. And I'm like, well, yeah, you can't lose. How can you lose two in a row? Right? I need to think. I'm like, God damn it. $8,000 in like 2 nights. Full paycheck.
Man.
I could use that $8,000 by now, right now, by the way.
But we had a good time in Vancouver. Dean Malcock, what a great guy. Scouting now, I think, still for Boston. And Hershey and I, and we had a lot of laughs, the three of us. It was a good
time. Is that who Mally is when you guys say Mally?
Dean Malcock.
But McGillney would hang out with us too.
What was he like to hang out with?
Awesome.
Yeah. He was a little more quiet, a little more reserved, but when you got him, like, he was pretty fun. He was always hanging out with you. He's a pretty good guy. Really good.
Hard to believe a guy hanging out in Russ's crew would be a little more reserved than Russ.
So he, spent the first part of his career in Buffalo. And when he got to Vancouver, he didn't understand, like, the tipping, you know, how much do we tip? And and his English was good for the Russian players, but you know, he still had some areas where he needed to work on, and he was single, and really my wife and I always believed that he just couldn't wait to get married and have kids. He wasn't out a lot and stuff.
Why?
But he loved eating good food, drinking good wine, had beautiful suits, watches, you know, he loved the finer things in life. And
right.
And he taught us a lot about a lot of that stuff, like watches and clothes and stuff, and cars especially. But
really,
I remember he's a bachelor, right? And we're in Toronto afternoon. There's this beautiful frickin' bartender serving us drinks, and he is smitten.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, what should I say? What should I say? And somebody said, hey, are you Russian? And she says, no. And he goes, would you like a little
Indian? Oh, would you like a little Indian?
Yeah, would you like a little Indian? And she, I thought she was going to come across the bar and freaking kill him. He was embarrassed. Oh, he was more embarrassed than she was. He, you know, with the English and everything. Oh, my God. It was, I'm like, I don't think that's what she wanted to say, pig fella.
We went out in Dallas one night, and he accidentally left a $3,000 leather jacket at the restaurant. And the next day, he's like, nah, I'll just leave it there.
No.
You didn't go get it.
He just bought it on that trip, too.
I'm like, oh, all right. Maybe I'll go get it.
Yeah, he bought it in Anaheim. I was with him. We were in Anaheim, went into a Versace store or Prada or something like that. Bought this beautiful black leather jacket with a fur collar. and we go to, it was Da Vinci's in, oh no, it was Acadora
Pomodoro in Dallas.
Acadora Pomodoro in Dallas. Yeah. And, he left it in the coat check and it was gone. Bye-bye. Things still smell brand new.
Yeah. That's kind of like a Derek, that reminds me of a Derek Sanderson story I read in his book where he'd go do that. It was all lit up. He'd buy golf clubs.
Yeah.
Because he never traveled and then he just leave them there.
It was so different back then, right? Because now they charter, but we would stay overnight in a lot of places. And sometimes we'd fly commercial. And then Russ would gather everybody around and he'd look at the plane tickets, wherever, what the seats were. All right, Hershey, B. He'd hand me the middle seat. Okay. All right.
And I would just the middle seat.
No. Russ would be like, give me your ticket. Because Russ would have the middle, right? Got a window? And I'd be like, I got a window. Fuck. Here's B. All right. I'm not a rookie. You just got it, right? You take it.
Yeah.
Tell us, Corey, something we wouldn't know about. I'm throwing you out of the bus. Something we wouldn't know about Russ. You guys played together. How many years in Vancouver then?
Just a couple about Russ.
Two, yeah.
Something good or something funny or something? Like, what do you want?
Way offside, a lot of dude. Things. Go way offside.
Russ was funny. Russ was
forget
never
the good
way
shit.
Offside.
We'll get to that later. No good shit right now. We'll get to that later.
No, Russ was never really way offside. Russ was just the ringleader, and he would just always take the young guys out. He believed that, you know, the NHL was to be enjoyed and it was a once in a lifetime experience. It was going to end quickly. So he'd really take care of the young guys. You know, as far as stories off the top of my head, it's tough to get some out of Russ, but he told me one time, he gave me the words of wisdom that I've taken in my life. It's like Socrates. And he said, it doesn't matter what you do the night before a game, as long as you're sitting down.
So what does that mean? It doesn't matter what you're doing the night before a game, as long as you're doing it sitting down.
So my theory was you had to rest your legs, right? The night before a game.
Sure.
Guys are out. Some guys would go and they'd walk all over the place. And then you'd hear guys in the morning go, oh, my legs, my legs, my legs. When I got to Montreal, I couldn't believe it. So I'm 23 years old. I played in Toronto for parts of 5 years. And it was, you know, we're a young team. We were dysfunctional at times, but we were a younger team. And get to Montreal and you got all these Hall of Famers. They've won cups. And you on the road, you put your bag in your room. We're already in a suit, no tie. That's casual back then. Downstairs, everybody meet in the lobby bar for two beers. Mm-hmm. And then you decide where you'd go for dinner. So if you wanted Italian, this group would be going that way.
Sure.
If you want sushi, this group's going that way. If you want steaks, this group's going that way. And we'd all go for dinner at the same time, come back to the bar and have a drink, and then we'd go to bed night before a game. Pretty standard. And we lost
night before a game.
Yeah, and we lost the cup that year to Calgary. I mean, we were a freaking good team. And I just learned from those guys that, you know, getting prepared and being ready to play. And here's Paris sneaking in.
A little token, Paris. Appearance by Paris.
Doing a flyby. She's going in for ice.
Oh, okay.
But anyways, I told her, Corey and Mally, and I just said, hey, as long as we're sitting down, we're okay.
He's like right up there with Sir Winston Churchill. Any of those, big speakers. But Russ, I want to go back to the Montreal. You said you lost in Calgary, right? Against Calgary. Was that the series where you ran Mike Vernon?
Yeah. Game six.
There we go.
So I turned to Pat Burns. We were losing. And I said, I got to do something. So dumped it in and he came out, played the puck as he always did. And I went flying down the right side and I ran him, and then you know, we still lost the game.
But, did you get a penalty for that? Because back then
I did.
You could run the goalie.
Yeah, I did get
it. It was fun. I did get a penalty. You know, trying to kill a guy.
Yeah.
Hey, Corey, talk about I don't know where to start from where you are now to working backwards to your career, but if you got it right, January 19th, 1993 was your first game in the NHL, one of the shows we've had with Russ, when he talks about the day, I don't know, the day he got drafted, Russ, or the first day you stepped on the ice, was just a fantastic experience for you. I'm guessing you remember that day, Corey?
Yeah. I just got called up. Mike Richter wasn't playing very well. Gave me a start in Detroit. And Russ, I don't know if you felt like this, but my first NHL game, I always thought was, I wouldn't say it was the easiest, but I've never been more prepared to play a game in my life. Because you sit there and you dream about it since you're a little kid. It's so fast. You don't have time to think. And when things slow down and, you know, you get a couple years in and you start thinking, it's like golf, right? You get out there, you just hit the ball. And then by the time you think you're good, you know, you stand over the ball, you got six swing thoughts. So the first game, you don't even think. You're just out there playing, just trying to keep up, right? Mm-hmm. It was against Yzerman, and I think Cheveldayoff was the other goalie in the other end. But God, I'll tell you what, yeah. Cool story is that a few years ago, the last year in the Joe, I got to take my son's hockey team to one of the last games in the Joe before they tore it down. So we sat in the end where I got my first start. So I got to take my boy to a game at the gym where I got my first NHL start. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was
Joe Louis Arena, right?
Yeah. Joe Louis Arena. So that, you know, that was a pretty cool moment. I don't know if he gave a shit, but I sure did. Hey son, I used to play in the NHL. He's like, yeah, Dad, I know. You don't stop talking about it. So I got another Russ story.
Oh yeah, play it honest. Yeah. So everyone sit down, strap in. Okay.
Russ gives me a ride home once. And Russ, I don't even know if you remember this. Gives me a ride home. And I'm like, hey, just drop me off across the street right here so you don't have to turn around and go the other way. You can just keep going. So he drops me off and I'm standing on the street corner and he stops and he rolls down his window and I'm like, what does he want? He's like, hey, Hershey, watch out. Don't get hit by a car. You know, I want you to be safe. And I go, ah, thanks, Russ. That's really nice. He says, ah, don't worry about it. Go through your legs anyways.
Oh, no. Uh-oh. No. No.
And then he drives away.
Yeah.
Beep,
yeah.
Beep. See ya.
Feel my pain. Does it piss you off, Corey, when you read about this, you know, you won the silver for Canada in the Olympics, and then it became this story of Peter Forsberg scoring this goal on you. And I read today they made a stamp out of that. I don't know if that's true or not. And I went, that's kind of a weird thing. You know, if you're Corey Hirsch going, oh, this is great. Okay, it was bad enough that this
fuck,
guy.
Not if you're Sweden.
Well, yeah, I'll tell I you guess. What. So I went and played in Sweden at the end of my career, and I'd get that all the time from the fans, and I'd be like, hey, guess what? When you use that stamp, you're actually licking my ass. So enjoy it.
That's good.
Enjoy it.
Oh, my God. That's funny.
Beautiful. It didn't bug you too much?
It did when I was younger, but it was just too immature, right? Like stupid. But I'll tell you what, I got a better story about the Olympic medal. You know, which I brought with me, of course. So there it is.
Oh, well, let's see. Humble brag.
Wow.
Only because Russ didn't get one when he was in the Olympics.
Yeah, I got a participation medal.
Yeah. We hold up pictures of the Stanley Cup too for Russ. He never got one.
I sort of got one. I can't really take credit for it though. I was a third goalie. But so anyway.
If I was even close to sniffing one, I'd be holding it up.
I drank out of it and it was very it was like drinking out of a can of corn. You know, you take the top off, it was very tinny. but anyways, and also, you know, everybody, there's hepatitis in there. There's
Jesus.
Herpy, whatever, you know, like you're drinking out of it though, but people got cold sore. It's like, anyways,
beautiful.
No, it's, but anyway, so I come back from the Olympics. I don't want to go to the minors, right? I'm pretty cocky. I think I was just the best player at the Olympics. I got a silver medal. Right. So I go up to New York. I'm there for about a week and they're going to send me down and I don't want to go down. So Mike Keenan calls me into his office to send me down and I go in there. He's like, sit down. So I go, I sit on the chair across from him and Russ, you know, Mike, he's like,
yeah,
looks at his page, doesn't really put his head up. He's kind of like, hey, here, you don't want to go down to the minors. And I'm like, no, I think I'm ready to play in the NHL. He looks up to me, goes, "You only got a silver medal, not a gold. Get your ass down to the minors."
Jesus Christ.
"Close the door on your way out." That was,
oh my God.
That was Mike. That's, yeah, that was
that's Mike. Vintage Mike.
Oh, fuck.
Does anybody, Russ, Corey, does anyone have a good story about Mike Keenan?
Actually, my brother Jeff liked him, but fuck, he didn't. And what's crazy, Jeff's mother-in-law died of cancer, and Mike wouldn't let Jeff go to the funeral.
Come on.
No.
It's all about control, right?
Yeah.
Chaos.
Just a control freak.
He felt if the room got too comfortable that the guys wouldn't play well on the ice, right?
Yeah.
I liked his philosophies on winning, but he just couldn't help himself from taking it a step too far. I saw stuff that was, it was Mike. Man, I had worse coaches though. Not that I'm going to name on here. Mark Crawford.
Why? We got to hear that. You give us something.
You know what? I don't, honestly, nope. I don't want to get into it. It's
you gave the name.
Hey, Corey,
maybe Russ has got one.
I never played for him, but Jeff and I are retired, and we remember our fishing derby up.
Oh yeah,
for Canuck Place. So we had handed it over to the Canucks, to Mess, and then to Brian Burke, the Canucks. So Burkey asked Jeff and I to come back, so we come with all the regular Canuck players, and Crow, Mark Crawford's up there. It's his first, he's going to start coaching the Canucks, and he starts bragging about Colorado and what he did. I did this and I did that, and I'm going to do this here, and I'm going to do this for this team, and you watch, we're going to win and all this stuff. And Jeff yells out, "Fuck, Crow. You opened the door and let Sackett go out. When he couldn't score, you let Forsberg go out. Fuck off. And then you had Patrick Waugh in net. You did fuck all."
Open the gate.
Oh, and everybody in the room started laughing. He was so pissed off. He didn't talk to Jeff the rest of the weekend.
Oh, man. Russ, I got a little story about that fishing derby. So remember Kevin Gogan used to come up?
Yeah, I just text Kevin Sunday just to see if I had his
doing?
Number.
Doing all right?
He's doing great. Thanks.
Okay. So these guys, what is he, about 6'5", 350 at the time?
6'7", 330 or something like that.
Two and A's like 6'4", like 280 or something, right? So they're at Russ's fishing derby, and I'm there. And I'm 5'10", about 165, right? And Kevin Gogan, and he looks over at me, and he's like, "I'm going to eat you, Hershey." And I actually thought he was going to. So then there's a couch in the lodge. I remember there was a couch in the lodge. And I was sitting in the corner just hanging out. Everybody's having beers and we're all having laughs. Kevin Gogan comes over and sits on me. You can't see me. Like, you wouldn't know. If he sat there for 4 hours, you would not know that I was sitting in behind him. Right, like, and I was just like, "Holy no!" But you know what? They were having fun. We had fun.
They're good guys, great guys. And poor Tune, he passed away soon after that trip.
Yeah, and just a nice man, just a good guy. Yeah. Well, but yeah, that was fun. That was
it was a good time.
Are you there? You got caught up in the storm. You remember that?
Oh my
you
god!
You got caught up in this. That's the smallest I've ever felt in my life.
Yeah,
like when 12-foot waves.
We lost 3 boats.
Yeah.
What?
3. So there's a guy.
The Queen Charlotte Lodge, right?
Yeah.
Russ,
Queen Charlotte. Up in Queen Charlotte. So there's a guide and 2 fishermen in each boat. So a hockey player and somebody who paid $20,000 to fish with them. You know it. And 3 of the boats capsized. We never found them again. We rescued the 3 guys out of each boat, got them onto the big boat that served
Coast Guard
food.
Came out.
It was a half an hour ride back to the lodge. It took us 2 hours in the sea, the swells that we were in. It was
scary.
It was disgusting. Guys were crying.
Yeah. That's the first time. That was when I realized I am just a speck on this earth. Like my nature.
Yeah.
Wow. That's
you scared shitless.
That was eye opening. Yeah. I think I did shit my pants actually.
Yeah. Good. I hope so. My one of my favorites was so Mess took that over. Mark Messier took that over that you and Jeff started and mm-hmm. your family, Russ, for Canuck House.
Canuck Place.
And so when Mess came there, he loved the idea. It was called Mess's Derby Classic or something. So I got invited up to do it, to hang out and do the emceeing and stuff. And one of my all time favorites is Mess never, you know, he wasn't really, you know, hard to get along with, you know, but when he spoke something, I didn't play for him, of course. I never played in the NHL, but when he did say, okay, I don't want you to do this.
Yeah.
Okay. You fucking knew, okay, do not do this. Okay. Do not do this. And Tom Arnold was up there at this thing and he was kind of loud and crazy, you know, to the actor. Yeah. And he was getting a little loud and you could see Mess getting kind of irritated, but what could he do about this? And then I got on stage and said, everyone calm down, because Mark wanted to bring out the owner. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I could see he was getting a little tired of Tom screaming and yelling all the time. And Mark introduced the owner, this guy. And nice man, the guy who owned that lodge. But he had big eyebrows. Okay. Mm-hmm. He had really big, bushy eyebrows.
Dave Husby.
Yeah, Dave Husby. And he came out and Mark is giving it the big, okay, everyone, I need your attention. Our host, you know, for this week is, you know, Dave Husby, and we really need to thank him a lot. And you know, Mess expecting this, you know, round of applause and standing O. And then all you can hear is Tom Arnold in the back going, what's with the fucking eyebrows, dude? What's and I thought that was my most vivid memory of that trip because I thought Moose is gonna take him out. But Corey, when you look back here, we want to.
You don't want more Russ stories?
I got absolutely yes. Yeah, let's go, man. Let's go.
Russ knew everybody. And they're not bad stories. Russ was married at the time, so you know he was good. He was a good boy when he yeah. you know. But he always wanted us to have fun. So yeah. I used to go golfing with Russ at Sherwood, and then he'd be like, "Hey, you're golfing with Jason Bateman today."
Ozarks.
I'm like, "What?" So I golf with Jason Bateman, and then we're leaving. And he's like, Hershey, I want you to meet my friend. He goes, hey, meet my friend, Corey Hirsch. No. So I go up and I shake Meatloaf's hand. I'm like,
oh, there you go.
Yeah. And it was just, Russ always had something going. He got us into the Playboy Mansion. So we went in there.
Fuck, and I didn't go either.
God, did that place need a renovation, though? You could just... It was
Fuck, my dad taught me when I was young, you there's two answers to every question. Yes or no. So I knew a lot of people and know a lot of people. Right. And I prided myself on getting into restaurants and bars and the actors that I'd met. I wanted all these guys to meet them. But the odd time somebody would ask me a question and I'm like, yeah, no problem, no problem. And then I would scramble to figure out how to figure it out. So Dean Melcock or somebody asked, hey, Russ, can you get us into the Playboy Mansion? And I said, yeah, no problem. Fuck, I'd never been there. And I called, get this, I called the Playboy Mansion. I got the number from Tom Arnold. I go, give me the number for the... So I call and I said, hi, it's Russ Courtnell from the Vancouver Canucks. We're playing the LA Kings tomorrow night or two nights from now. And I'd like to bring the guys... to show them the mansion, is it possible? And they were like, absolutely. So I freaking did this. And then I went wine shopping and went and saw my Paris's grandmother. And so I didn't go to the Playboy Mansion. I think you guys had lunch there, didn't you?
We did. And then we played volleyball with a bunch of 40 Playboy models, bikinis. Actually, no, that's bullshit. There was only one left.
Hey, nobody was there.
There's only
you
one.
You could just
there.
Go with it. Yeah. But that's the truth behind that. But behind that story of me getting them in was just me being me and going, okay, fuck it. How am I going to figure out how to do this? And I pulled it off.
Hef came out, got a picture with us.
Yeah, you guys met him, right?
I met him. I call him Hef. We're on first name basis right now.
There we are. Of course you were.
Hey, Hef.
Is everyone, when you go to the Playboy Mansion, okay, for those of us who, let's see, would never be able to go to the Playboy Mansion. And you hear these stories. Is everyone getting laid when they get in there? Is it just like one big or what happens there? I don't need personal stories.
What happens there? Well, when I was there, I mean, it was like, it was a free for all, right? No, it's, you know what? It was very quiet. It was a, They got a zoo in the back. I went into the grotto.
Yeah.
That smells like orgy. not that I've ever been to one, but I'm sure. Right. I'm sure it does. They stopped me at the gate. They're like, "You're not good looking enough to come in here." And I was like, "Oh, come on." I had to talk my way in.
My wife used to go to movie nights there. Paris was an actress, and her mom used to phone Hefner and say, "Okay, my daughter's coming to movie night. After the movie's over, you get her out of there." Sarah Vaughan, Paris's mom. And she, so Paris has, I don't know if she walks by, I'll ask her how many times she's been, but she's been quite a few times. And they, you know, they'd show a movie and then
she's stunningly gorgeous.
I mean, yeah. And then they Hef would go, "Paris, time to leave." And she'd have to leave the party. Otherwise, Sarah Vaughan would be coming down there and not kick the shit out of Hef, but he'd be in trouble.
What's the Bill Cosby thing? Do we want to, what's that story?
Well, we've all heard about Bill Cosby and, you know, what he's done and what he's accused of doing. Well, my wife was working on one of his shows. Bill Cosby used to open for her mom, Sarah Vaughan.
Oh, sure.
Right, yeah, right. The Playboy Jazz Festival. So Bill would introduce all the acts. He loved jazz. And so they were friends, Sarah and Bill. So Paris is a working actress. She's working on one of the shows, and he invites her and another actress to his house for dinner. Paris thinks that it's everybody from the show's coming, because they had these wrap parties and stuff after a week's worth of work. People go for dinner, and I've been to a few when Tony Danza was doing Who's the Boss, and so it's normal. So he says, "I'll send my car and pick you guys up. Give me your address." So they give the address. They get her and this girl get picked up. They go to Bill Cosby's house, and it's Bill and the star of Mod Squad, guy just passed away recently. And he has a butler, chef, butler, whatever. So Paris had phoned her mom and said, "Hey, Bill invited me to his house for dinner tonight. I'm going with this girl." And Sarah said, "Oh, make sure you say hello to the butler," whatever his name was. So Paris is sitting, nothing's going on. She said it was awkward because it was just the two of them and her, and so it was weird. She's like, but they're sitting down for dinner, and this guy comes over with their plate of food, and she looks up at him and goes, "Hey, my mom said to say hi, is your name so-and-so?" And he goes, "Yes, it is." He goes, "Who's your mom?" And she goes, "Sarah Vaughan." He goes over to Bill Cosby, whispers in his ear, and they go out of the room, and Bill comes back in and with the butler and says, "Okay, dinner's over. You guys are out of here," and kicked him out of the house.
Oh, no.
As soon as he found out it was Sarah's daughter, his friend, the game was over. Thank freaking God.
Thank God.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Hey, like just
yeah. Yeah, could have gone really
the
badly
other way for sure.
Yeah.
Well, on that high note,
let's get into my suicide attempt too. You want to do that?
segue into suicide.
I'll save it. I'll save the suspense for you. I lived.
Unbelievable the way you say that. I said at the top of the show. You know, I was always impressed. Was it Bell Globe Media, right? Years ago, with the awareness about mental health, and I worked for Bell when I did the radio show. They owned the company that I did that morning show for with Steve, our producer here. And you know, Michael Landsberg was one of the first guys I remember from TSN to come out and talk about his depression and mental health and anxiety. And then we've got this incredible day, right, of awareness. And then I saw your name pop up as my buddy called him. He goes, is that the ginger goalie from Vancouver, that Corey Hirsch?" And I said, "Yeah." So I've been following your story. And then I, knowing you were coming on, I regrouped, you know, back around and read this article about you. And I got to admit, I was
Touched by his story?
Totally. Yeah. Totally. You know, it was just so moving, and it's just an incredible, incredible story that you came out on the other side. And the opening of that piece was you had decided to kill yourself. I hate to sort of go there right away, but that's what it was about. And then your whole story about how you came out of it and about OCD. And it's just remarkable. It's remarkable, Corey, what you went through. And I hope everyone listening to this reads that piece and hears what you said and hears what you have to say about it. I don't know where to start, to be honest with you, Corey, about it, about your personal life and what you've been through. So I'm going to throw it to you.
You know what? Like I said, they'll save you the suspense. I live, right? I'm here, which right. is good. You know what? It wasn't, when I look back, it wasn't that I wanted to die. Like I didn't want to. I had these really repetitive thoughts that wouldn't stop. And they're dark and they're horrific and they're, it's like you get a wave of anxiety with it. Like it's getting hit with a taser gun. That's the best way I can explain OCD. And you end up just spinning in your own brain, trying to figure things out. Am I an axe murderer? There's harm thoughts. There's sexual intrusive. There's all sorts of different ones. But it's typically, somebody that cares too much that they go internal and it's like, oh, I don't want to ever do that. Right. Like people that have, germ OCD. I'm just trying to explain this quickly. So I'll explain this quickly.
OCD, take your time.
And I'll get into it. So you ever been driving down the road in your car? Now, I think this is in the Tommy Boy movie where you're like, you get that impulse thought to turn the wheel, right? You're like, and then you're like, oh, what did I think of that? Right. A normal brain would go, turn the wheel into oncoming traffic. A normal brain would go, oh, that was a stupid thought. And they would just keep going. A brain like mine would go, why did you think that? Does that mean you want to kill people? Does that mean you want to hurt people? Does that mean you want to create a big accident? Does that mean you want to, right? What if, what if, what if, what if? And that's the best way I can describe it. I would go home and repetitively think about why I had that thought, and it would never ever stop. It was 24/7. It would be on a loop. There was way worse than that. But
when did that start, Corey? When did all that start for you?
Where I was 21 years old. I was in a bar I was sitting with a bunch of guys. Like I was a black ace with the Rangers, and I had a thought. I don't really like to talk about the content. The content's always garbage. It doesn't matter whether it's sexual, whether mm-hmm. it's harm, whether it's religious, whether it's whatever. It's all garbage, right? None of these people are like this. I wasn't, but yeah. So, anyways. I was out and all of a sudden I just got a thought and I was like, it just didn't stop. And I'm like, it was repetitive, 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 repetitive. And I couldn't make it stop. And it was 3 years, 4 years after that, 24 hours a day, 7 days where you have this, almost the same repetitive thought in your head. So the best way I can explain it is like, people that have harm thoughts, they won't touch knives because they think they're going to stab somebody with it. They're not going to, right? They're the kindest people in the world. Let's get off of the OCD and how, because it's really difficult to explain. But the article that came out, the writer, right? We have a ghostwriter. Like I can't write that well. He did such a great job of explaining it. I can't even explain it myself that way, as you just see. So I was like, when I got it back from him, I was like, were you sitting in the car with me? Like that's how well it was written. And that's why it hit so hard. But ultimately, I just wanted the thoughts to stop. I just didn't know any other way out. Right. Like it was just, every day you would wake up and it would be there right to the time you went to bed and it would never, ever stop. And it would be like horrific thoughts. Like, are you going to pick up that knife and stab, your dog? Right. And you would never do it. And it's hard to, I still feel weird explaining it. Cause now I think people are going to think I want to stab my dog.
Right. In the article, you're saying this guy was such a great writer. I'm quoting, you talked about these being to give people an idea of, that it was unrelenting. It was crippling. It was hammered with mental images of themselves committing acts of violence that you talk about. And it was like exhausting to read it. I was so anxious reading it going, oh my God, what this guy went through. When you read that unrelenting and crippling thing, it went on for how long for you, Corey?
3 or 4 years. Yeah. Till I finally, was when Russ was there, when I kind of went, after a while I got to just basically learn how to live after the attempt that I made. I was like, I'm just going to live with this. After I stopped the car, and that's just what it is. Right. I'm just going to try and live with it. And there was a lot of bad days, but then the Rangers get an idea of this, and cause I'm late for meetings. I'm playing well though on the ice. Like that's cause that was my sanctuary. Mm-hmm. But you know, the Rangers, like something's off, right? Like I'm not, you know, I look like a shitty teammate ultimately because I'm late. I don't stay on the ice after practice. I don't come early. Because I just wanted to be, I didn't want anybody to know. So you didn't spend, I spent as little time. So I just learned how to deal with it. And then eventually it's like a broken leg. Like you can't just walk around with a broken leg for 3 years and go, nothing's going on here. Right. Eventually you got to get it fixed. And, eventually I just crashed. I just crashed again, probably halfway through my second year in Vancouver. And, none of the guys like Russ, and you can talk to this, you know, I had learned to hide it so well that, none of the guys really, really knew about it. But I'm in New Jersey, and Russ, you can say from your side, but this was my lowest point. I played the night before against the Islanders, terrible, but I'm really starting to crash now. Like I'm having panic attack after panic attack. I'm down to about 145 pounds. Guys are looking at me like, what the hell's wrong with you? And then so the next day in New Jersey, I was supposed to start that night again. Kirk had gotten hurt. And I get in the net and I can't see pucks. Like I'm having like an out of body experience. They call it depersonalization or something. I didn't know what it was. So I'm like, I can't play. Like I can't, I'm done. So I skate over to Tom Rennie and I'm like, Tom, I can't play. And then so I leave the ice and all the guys are like going, what the fuck's going on? So they call an emergency team meeting and I'm sitting in the corner with my head and my knees and I'm just so embarrassed and ashamed. Right. And I'm having panic attacks and now it's just blown up in front of my teammates. Right. So nothing more embarrassing and shameful than that. And, Tom Rennie says, hey, Hershey's not doing very well. We're just going to say he's got the flu. And, I think it was Mike Fountain's going to start. So all the guys just kind of go, you know, one by one by me, just kind of looking at me. And there's a few guys that, you know, Russ would come over and say, hey, Hershey, you know, we got you, whatever. Right. Like there's a few guys that I've told Russ like millions of times, I thank him for this, but, you know, it was the most embarrassing moment probably of my life. And I got on the bus and I sat at the front of the bus as guys shuffled by 1-on-1. And I was like, I just threw away my NHL career. But it was as shameful and embarrassing as it was to be in that situation. I also saved my own life that day because I went and I asked for help. And I was like, I've got two choices. I can really end it this time or I can ask for help. And I was like, well, if I ask for help and there's no solution, well, then I can kill myself. Right. So that was kind of the thought process. But the whole idea of the article was to say, look, there's always help. Help is available. You just have to go and get it. And I say, I am living proof of that, that it gets better. And then ultimately, you know, it was kind of the downfall of my NHL career because it was just, you know, I got diagnosed with OCD when I got back to Vancouver, but it was a long road from there. And I still tried to hide it. Right. I didn't want the guys to know, but it was like, it was obvious. We had a team meeting where I was, you know, I was in the corner. I was like my head and my knees and Russ, you know, speak to what you saw, because from your perspective, if you remember, do you remember that meeting?
I'm remembering it now, but what I remember is you really struggling. And do you remember like before games, like right before we're going on the ice, you would go in the trainer's room and call your then girlfriend or friend, or do you remember?
I was just trying to distract my brain. I would be like, yeah, I'd get a thought and I just would have to like.
Yeah. So Corey was doing some really different things, you know, and you could see him falling apart mentally and emotionally. And he was sad. Like he's like most people who are suffering. He was just really sad. There was no happiness in his body. And as a teammate, it was troubling and worrisome. And he was losing weight, and you could tell, you know, that something was really bad in his life, but we didn't know. Like I would say most of the players thought he was having a hard time with his girlfriend and their fiance or whatever. And, you know, guys started blaming her. Just natural, right? They're trying to find a way to stick up for their teammate or blame somebody else other than Corey. And
well, there's a stigma back then, right, Russ? Like
stigma for sure. And my dad went through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, because I had lived it with my father and then I had struggled in Montreal, I didn't have suicide thoughts, but I had a severe depression and I ended up 5 therapy sessions and then went on to have my best year up until that point. And so I was fine, but I didn't have suicide thoughts. I just couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep and I couldn't stop thinking about a breakup that I had. I broke up with a girlfriend and mine was, I brought it on myself. Mm-hmm. So, but what Corey was going through was way deeper than anyone knew. Nobody in that room knew what we know today. And when I read Corey's story, it was so emotional because he was my buddy and he is my buddy and mm-hmm. he was my teammate. And I just watched him just fall apart. And it was, you know, in so many personally, selfishly, professionally, it was just hard to watch. And,
Russ, I'll stop you there because you were always extremely compassionate and kind. And I would say a third of the team were good to me. There was guys that were good that were trying to understand, like Russ, Babich, some of the guys. Second third of the team didn't really care. They were just like, well, you know, whatever, and just let me play my game. And we just, you know, won't hang out with them. And then the other third treated me like the plague, mm-hmm. trying to get me traded, you know, bad guy, all that stuff. But you know, it was people like Russ that kept me going, right? That understood. And here's the thing though, that's the stuff you got to look for right today that we know more, that it's better. And sorry, the shows that we've cut, it's kind of gotten dark, you guys. Those are the things you got to look for, right? Like the year before Russ, hey, like I was having fun. I was, I was hanging out.
We had a blast.
And then all of a sudden someone just falls off a cliff, right? Like mm-hmm. It's your kid, their grades, they go from an A student to a D student, right? Like mm-hmm. something's up or, you know, a friend that's a good hockey player or whatever, just, you know, they start hanging out with other people or they isolate themselves. Mm-hmm. Russ, I stopped hanging out with the guys, right? Like those are the things you need to look for. If they do, you got to have a conversation with people. We know better now, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing is we know better now. And to defend some of those teammates back then,
they didn't know.
They just didn't know, and it is what it is. We were all supposed to be tough, hard-nosed, like, you know, everything was all about winning and, you know, fuck this, fuck that. Right. And, you know, today that wouldn't happen. That, like just the knowledge we have on so many different levels of different things and especially mental health. I mean, they'd be finding you, but they would, I mean, when I went into therapy in Montreal, they freaking hid it. Like they hid me. I had to go to this far end of the city and take a cab, right? Walk 2 blocks, go in the back door, make sure nobody saw me because they didn't want in the media. Well. Yeah. And they were helping me and they did help me. And Serge Savard was unfreaking believable, but it was a big secret.
Oh yeah. The guy that diagnosed me came to my apartment. Right. That's I didn't go anywhere, but I'll say two things here and then we can move on because, you know, we want to have some fun here too. But one is there's a massive stigma on medication. Medication has saved my life. I would not be here today without medication. Now, does that mean I'm pushing pharma? No. But if you need medication, you are no less of a person than anybody.
Yeah, agreed.
And we make people feel like they are less of a person. Do we make people feel less because they've had cancer and they take medication for? No. But if it's for their brain, we make people feel like they're crazy or they're whatever. And, you know, that's something that has to end. And you know what? I talk a lot about masculinity, Russ, and I'll throw this to you too, is that let's say I did end up killing myself that day. Do you think that all my buddies would have came to my funeral and said, yeah, he sucked it up. What a man. He didn't tell anybody. You know, he went out like a man. We didn't see him cry. We didn't see him talk. No, you know what, Russ? Like you probably would have said, and all my, they'd be like, why didn't he tell somebody?
Yeah.
Why didn't he talk to me? I could have got him some help, right? So if you're out there thinking that you're too masculine to talk to somebody, well, that's bullshit. Right. Yeah. Because I would rather talk to you and get you the help than end up going to your funeral. Right. And I think as guys, we're all like that. But we want to hold it in. And we've been taught you can still be a man and fucking deal with your problems. Right. Yeah. Like,
it is, you're so right. Cause it through our fundraiser in Victoria for mental health and talking about it, it is the message that we all tell everyone is that if you're struggling, you need, don't tell a friend, don't tell a loved one, just go call your doctor and tell them you're struggling and you need help, and then go tell your family, because family's not always going to, or friends aren't always going to give you correct advice. Usually they're going to give you the wrong advice, and a professional is going to help you a hell of a lot more than a family member who's not a doctor, who doesn't understand. And I remember when my dad was sick, everyone, they also just, Archie, you're tough. Suck it up. Come on, Archie, suck it up. You know, and I just watched the greatest, you know, human being fall apart in my eyes. And it was terrible.
Oh, Russ, I'm so sorry that, you know, I've had a suicide in my life too. And that's the, there's nothing worse. There really isn't, because they take all the answers with them. There was one more thing I had to say, but I can't remember because I've been hit in the head too many times with too many pucks.
Well, fuck, thank God they hit you in the head. That means you saved one.
Jesus.
But I do say about suicide is that the pain may go away for the person who dies, but it is passed on to all the loved ones that love that person.
Oh, right.
They carry that forever. And so, somebody may commit suicide, but that pain never leaves the other people.
Here's the worst thing you can do. And please don't do it. If you're out there listening, when you're talking to somebody that's suicidal, do not point out how great their life is.
Yeah.
Because at that point, it just makes them feel even worse and more guilty because they're having those thoughts. It buries them even further. So pointing out how great their life is doesn't help, because I had an Olympic silver medal and I drank out of the Stanley Cup. You couldn't tell me how great my life was, right? Mm-hmm. And if you did, I would just feel shittier because I'm having these thoughts and that I've already felt like a horrible person, right?
So what do you do, Corey, to back up there for a second?
What you have to do is just listen. Sometimes people just want to tell their shit. Like sometimes people just got to get it out, right? Like they just want to know that somebody cares. Mm-hmm. So that's some way. If it's more severe than that, then you have to encourage them that there's help available, that we're going to get you help. I'm here for you. I'm going to listen. I'm going to, you know, and then you're going to, it really takes a village. It takes a community. So, if someone comes to you and they're suicidal, there's, you know, there's passive and active. Passive is, you know, someone that's thinking about it, that's reaching out. I actually like when someone comes to me and they say, I'm having thoughts of suicide. I want it, because I know that they want that help at that point. Right. And I can get them the help. And I can talk to people and we can get them the help. When somebody's active, where they actually have a plan and they know, like they've got it planned out, that's when I get scared, because typically they'll go quiet. But this is why we have to talk to our kids about this stuff. We got to stop sweeping it under the rug, suicide has to become, you know, not a taboo word in our society. Talking about suicide does not create more suicide. It actually lessens it. And you got to talk to your kids. You got to ask them where they're at. You got to, you know, you have to educate them on mental health. You have to let them know that it's okay. Even if they're having suicidal thoughts, hey man, that's okay. You know, it's not, we're not going to shame you for that. We're going to get you the help you need.
Right.
And that's the greatest thing you can do for your kids is just listen. Right.
Right.
My oldest daughter suffers from mental health issues, and she just started a Instagram account called We Are Dual Citizens. So anybody out there? Yeah, yeah. And she's been talking about health and food and mental health for a while now. And now she's created this new platform, and she's going to be putting out little things every day. And I think there'll be a clothing line that's attached to it and all this interesting stuff, but she's working with incredible people, and she just started it yesterday.
Oh, she's young and to take that on, Russ.
Yeah. Yeah, she is. And she's sharing her story. And, you know, even some of the things she's talking about that I didn't know about, but to Corey's point, because of our family history with our father, and I've suffered from some depression, and I sought out help every time that I suffered. I think I've been in therapy 5 different times since I've been about 25 years old. Haven't been in a long time, maybe about 2007 was the last time I was in therapy. And every time I got better or felt better and things were brighter and better when I got out. But we talked to our kids because of my dad. And we started when they were really young, and we educated them on their grandfather and what happened to him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And told them how great he was and what a strong man he was, but it crippled him. And so we told our kids there's no shame in getting help if you ever need it. And Allie eventually, I think when she was about 15, started going to therapy and got on medication. Now she's on different stuff. Like she's got a lot to say, and I told her, share your story. And now it's growing. Now she's doing all this other stuff. That's her idea, not mine. But she, like Corey, like me, when we talk to people, we try to tell them how normal it is and how they, you know, if they need help, they can get help. They just have to ask and don't keep it a secret.
You want your kids to not take their own life? Educate them in your house. Let them know it's okay to talk to you, right? It's simple.
I heard a great ad, you know, a guy told me, not talking about, not talking to your kids about mental health or addiction problems or whatever, not talking about mental health for fear that they're going to commit suicide. Wow. He said, it's the equivalent of not talking to your kids about fire safety in your house for fear a fucking fire is going to break out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous. Corey, you went a step further with this, and I'm wondering, with your celebrity status, when you did come forward about this, like I say, it's a remarkable story. We've only sort of touched on it here. Did someone approach you, like Russ did his daughter, and pressure you into saying we need to hear from you, Corey? You've got the ear. You are a recognized name, and would you talk about this thing? Obviously, you do now. Can you walk us through that? At what point did you say
no? When I was at my worst. By the way, I'm still in therapy from hanging out with Russ while I play.
And I'm about to go into therapy.
That's where most of my therapy.
I'll meet you there, Corey. I'll meet you there.
So you know what? No, actually. When I was at my worst and I was young and I was like, man, if I ever get through this, I'm going to try and help as many people as I can. But I didn't believe I'd ever get through it. Right. Like I thought I'd end up, you know, whatever. So then 10 years after I got diagnosed, I finally found a guy that could help me. For OCD people, if you're listening, ERP is the therapy that you need, not CBT, ERP. And it sucks. but it will make you better. But here's the other side of it. So it was 10 years after that, that my article came out in the Players Tribune. So I'm at a game in Arizona and I go and I sit down with a buddy of mine who's a player agent. He's got a player beside him that is an active player in the NHL. Well, he doesn't play for Arizona. He played for, I'm like, what the hell's he doing here? You know, he played for a different team that wasn't even playing that night. And I'm like, hey, how are you? What are you doing in town? He's like, I'm in rehab. I'm like, oh, you hurt your knee or whatever? He's like, no, I'm in rehab for drugs and alcohol in Arizona. So I'm like, all right, you know, I must be lonely. He's probably got a story. I'll go talk to him, see if I can help him, right? I'd never told anybody up to this point about my OCD. Mm-hmm. But other than my parents, maybe, or people close to me. So I take him for coffee the next day. He starts spitting out his story I started spitting mine out because I'm like, well, he's got to have issues, right? He's in rehab. So, mm-hmm. you know, I tell him about my OCD and all that. And he looks at me and goes, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm going through. And I'm like, I'd never talked to anybody or met anybody with OCD before. Now, him though, his mom had to resuscitate him twice from fentanyl overdoses.
Oh,
yeah. So then that was when I was like, the light bulb went out and I was like, holy shit, there, you know, I got to get my story out there because there are people like him that are struggling, right? That are you know, are dying or whatever, or are really struggling. So that from there, I was going to write a book. And then I met some people that, Catherine McCauley and Lana Quinn that really helped me from there said, no, let's get together with the Players Tribune. A book, some people will read it, some people won't, right? Like it won't hit the article because it's an article like that. It hits so fast. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so many people read it. I think it had 2 million hits in the first 2 hours. It blew up. And I was like, I was terrified before it came out. And it just absolutely blew up. And what I think helped it, you know, to get to that point was there's two things. One is that no one really ever talked, athletes ever really talked about suicide. And two was, is everybody thought OCD was hand washers. Oh, they wash their hands a lot.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they're clean. Right?
Right.
Yeah. Right. I did everything in my head.
Me included. Yes.
Yeah. Right. I did everything in my head. You couldn't see it. That's how I hit it though. Right. So those are the reasons I think. And then ultimately at the end of it, I'm like, fuck, I'm so happy that it didn't end on that mountain, right?
Yeah.
Because my kids and everything, other than meeting Russ,
you know, it's only you can make fun of saying Russ would make me want to drive my car off a fucking cliff. Jesus.
Hey, Corey, did you come when we landed in Phoenix, went to the hotel, and then we immediately got in cabs, went right back to the airport and chartered a plane to Vegas. Were you on that?
I wasn't on that, but we did it another time.
Okay.
I remember I spent a summer in Malibu.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. It's like freaking 11 at night. I'm in bed and Russ is like, get dressed. We're coming to pick you up. I'm like, Russ, what? We're going to Vegas. So I get on this charter plane. It's midnight and I end up in Vegas and I'm like, is this real life? Like, is this happening?
It is so weird, the table.
So have you ever seen the movies when the craps tables are just like on fire and it's like people are cheering? I'd never seen anything like that. So we go and play craps and I've never really played craps before. So I'm learning, but these guys are putting big money down, Russ and his buddies, right? They know how to play. And sure. The table is just pumping. People are cheering. The rolls are like flying, right? I'm putting like $25 chips down, right? So at the end of it, at the end of the night, we all go home and guys are like, yeah, fuck, I took 40 grand out of there. I took like 60 and 70.
No.
I'm like, Hershey, what'd you win? About $200. Actually, I may have even broke even. Yeah.
So back in the day, in the 90s, there's Clay Lacy is a private FBO. A lot of charters out of there. It's Van Nuys. You've probably flown out of there, Jimmy, with Wayne maybe once or twice.
Yeah. I have, yeah.
So from 9 p.m. till 9 a.m., they would have these private jets. 8 passengers, and Vanna White had one there and other celebrities. And I'd phone up, we'd be after dinner cocktailed. And I'd be like, do you got a plane? And they'd be, yep, we got one. And you couldn't leave before 9 p.m., but you had to be back by 9 a.m. So you had this 12-hour window in Vegas.
Fucking taxi.
And it was $3,000. So we would charter the plane. I'd put it on my credit card, and we'd go to the casino. We'd start playing for a couple hours, and I'd tell the boys, hey, I'll be right back. I'd go over to the window where you cash out, and I'd give them my receipt for the plane. And I said, see that table over there? We all were on this plane. Here's the bill. And they would freaking give me the money back.
Oh, shut it. Oh, yeah. Look at you go.
So then this went on for years. And then all of a sudden, economy goes up. Things change. I phone up there and they're like, hey, Russ, those days are over.
That's $40,000 now.
So anyways, nothing in Vegas is free, but we did get our reimbursement back from those plane trips. It was so much fun.
So good move. Do you remember we used to play cards on the plane, right?
Oh God, do I remember?
Well, so the games when I would play, they only got like to maybe $800,000. Guys didn't play for it, but that was in the Canucks, right? Guys didn't want the games to get out of hand. So that wasn't bad. So Donald Brashear gets traded to our team. He's like, hey, I got a game we used to play in Montreal. So I'm like, okay. So we start playing and all of a sudden I'm down like $17,000.
Jesus.
Like I'm down 17. Like I am shitting my pants. Like I don't have this. I don't have this kind of money. Right. Like, I mean, I didn't make that. So I battle back to about 6,000. Right. So I still, and I owe Russ.
Strong.
I owe Russ the six. And Russ is like, just give me two and we'll just call it a day. So Russ, thank you for that.
You're welcome. Do you remember Jim Dowd on that trip?
Oh, the cards is possessed.
When we land, he threw me his car keys.
His cards are possessed. I'm like,
yeah, Jesus. That thick accent. Yeah, take my car.
That's so funny.
You took my first NHL shutout puck too. Remember? I was in Boston. I did? It was one of
Give it back, Russ.
Yeah, Russ put it in his pocket. He's like, yeah, I don't know what happened to it, Hershey. And then he gave it to me when we got off the plane.
Oh, cool.
Or if you put your shoe, remember if you took your shoes off on the plane, someone would grab them and throw them out? Yeah. I have about four or five pairs of shoes.
Fantastic. Corey, what are you doing now? We got to get out of here.
I'm talking to you guys.
Yeah. other than that, yeah. No.
What am I doing? I'm the broadcaster for the Vancouver Canucks Radio. I do a lot of mental health speaking. I do a lot of
You got walking. A book coming out too,
I
don't
got
you?
A book coming out next 2021. I've got a podcast coming out with the Players Tribune that is going to be, I think, incredible.
What's that going to be about?
Mental health based with athletes and all that stuff and, you know, coming out the other side. And just, every once in a while, calling Russ and see what he's doing.
Are you single or you got a gal?
I'm on the fence right now. I've just got out of a relationship and, we'll see where it goes. Right.
Yeah.
And also if anybody has any advice on relationships out there, I could really use that.
I'll give you some. I'm really good at them.
You've
seen the movie Tommy Boy, right? He's got the bun and he's caressing it and he's like, my old bun. And then he starts tearing it apart. That's me with relationships.
Hey, there's this single cop in Edmonton.
Shut up. All right. Listen, we had a
What's her name? And she
asked Jimmy, he got punted.
Back down, everybody.
For stalking.
I can't believe. No.
Started walking by our house.
Can we get out of here now?
I do that with the Sedins here. I mean, I don't know what's the problem with that. I just hide in their bushes, right? Every morning they leave, and I'm like, hey, Daniel, hey, Henrik. Yeah, I'll be here when you get back.
Corey, we can't thank you enough, man.
It was fun, guys.
Well, it was, you made it fun. You made it, but what an incredible story.
So many more stories. We'll have to do it again.
We'll do it again. We'd love to get you on. Maybe, as I always tell our guests after a very successful show like this was, would you be into co-hosting a podcast with me?
Yeah. Why?
Because Russ is hurtful. He scares me. Anyway, we're all good, man. Corey, get back to doing what you're doing, man. I know anyone who's listened to this, when you talked about a book coming out, I will be waiting in line, man, to get that thing signed and read it for sure. It's something that affects everyone, and you sure put it in a good light for everyone. I got a lot out of what you said.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, well, all right. I've already sold the book. One. Russ, I love you, bud, like always.
Yeah, I love you too, Hirsch.
Take it easy, Corey.
Thanks for being with us. Please be sure to subscribe to The Suspendables today and share the show with your friends and followers. And find out everything you need to know about the show on our brand new website, thesuspendables.com.